Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Morelia Python Radio on this off night. Sorry for the technical difficulties we had last night, but here we are, and we're ready to talk about Carpet Fest. We're brought to you by MoreliaPythons.com, www.MoreliaPythons.com. Go over there and check it out. What's up, Owen? We have quite the
story. Oh, my God, we're here. Yeah.
Yes.
We can hear each other.
Yeah, it feels so weird, coming at it tonight because I'm, like, coming home from work thinking, oh, I'm just going to relax tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wait a minute.
I did the same thing because I told you, I'm like, I'm downstairs, I'm feeding the babies, and I'm like, doo-doo-doo, taking my time, you know, getting bit by a mech and things like that. And also, I'm like, oh, crap. And I'm like, hucking rats at snakes and closing cages and running. So, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it's just a weird night for all involved.
Yeah, so in this episode, we're going to be talking about the Northeast Carpet Fest, and then later on, we're going to be joined by Nick Mutton, and he has a research project that he is doing, and he wants to come on and talk about some of the details. But before we do that, we have Howard Redding of Redding Reptile Breeders coming on to chat with us about Carpet Fest. What's up, Howard? How you doing?
How the heck are you guys? Are we up and loaded and ready to run tonight?
We're rolling, baby.
We're going.
There's so many things I could say. This Carpet Fest was by far, I know I say this every year, but this, don't worry, I haven't gotten to you yet, Eric. Anyway, this Carpet Fest.
Not done yet.
It's coming.
I'm going to beat you to it.
Yeah.
Me to it, trust me. Carpet Fest this year was just spectacular. It was, you know, it was your brainchild, Eric. This is what you wanted to do. And this year was just the best ever. I was so happy. It was way laid back. Everybody had a great time. You know, we talked about snakes. We talked about our lives.
Yeah.
And it was incredible. And, oh, wow, there's so many different quotes that I could bring up. at one moment, I was, you know, I got to thank Zach and Eric for the evening before. They showed up unexpectedly. I didn't think they were coming that early. But they helped me out a lot. And Eric even had some certain things on his mind that he just cared to discuss very loudly.
Mm-hmm.
And I that were mere feet away, but he felt the need to share the passion.
I was feeling it, man. It was burning.
The point was made, and if I wasn't so ripped, I would have had that. I would have had it on my videotape. But anywho, And they came back the next morning early, and while I was trying to finish up some stuff, they more than, both Eric and Zach were more than happy to lend a hand to help me make this happen, because it is a lot of work.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
I also,
definitely.
Throughout the course of the day, I was trying to finish stuff up, so I didn't have time to drink. Yeah, I know that's odd.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric, my friend Eric, comes up to me and puts his arm around me and holds me close and says, "I'm more effed up than Howard. Who the hell says that?" Or when was the last time somebody said that?
But it didn't stop there. That was just the beginning. He kept drinking. And then eventually got to the point where he's sitting at a picnic table yelling across your backyard at me because I took his book and went close to the fire you had just set. He started screaming, "Are you burning my book?" Over and over again. No, you were screaming. You were screaming, "Stop burning my book." I'm like, "I'm not burning the book. I'm just reading the book. Stop burning the book." And at this point, I just wanted to huck it into the fire because you were annoying me. But, yeah.
No, that day was great. It was a great event. Eric loved everybody.
A lot of people.
Do that
go around.
Yeah.
And my response was, "This is what Carpet Fest is all about."
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you guys, and people that weren't here, and even the people that were, you know that it was great. It was perfect. Everything was fine. Everything worked out well. Everybody ate. Everybody laughed. It started to get taken over by Scrubs at one moment. But
yeah, Dave Means showed up and brought Scrub Pythons, and that kind of ruined it. We were all done after that point. So
let me give a shout-out to David Means. Solid guy, incredible Scrubs. I know nothing about Scrubs. Well, I do now.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, I knew nothing about Scrubs, and that one large animal that he brought was just spectacular. It was a very – it felt like velvet.
Yeah.
And it was way relaxed. It was an incredible experience.
Yeah. When I found out David Means was coming, I was like a giddy schoolgirl, because I was like, oh, you know how we always talk about, like, you're going to be able to rub shoulders with guys that, you know, have all this knowledge? Well, when it comes to scrub pythons, there's, like, a few people that I look up to that kind of know what they're talking about, and he's one of them, you know, and to be able to just to sit there and talk to him and pick his brain, I was talking to him about Scrub with shedding problems, and, you know, he gave me some suggestions and some tips, and, you know, it was great, you know. I did remember that. I did remember that. But
yeah, I found that the way stuff like that works is you remember everything up to a point, and then as the evening goes further, you forget what happened previously.
Right.
It's not like you don't remember those actions and what happened. It's just after the fact, you're kind of like, oh, yeah, okay. I don't know how much money I spent. I don't know what I bought. I was texting Owen and Eric, both of you, saying, all right, well, who won this?
Do I have to pay for that? No.
How much did – no. I paid for everything. It's like, how much did I pay for the vodka? How much did I pay for this? And back and forth, but it was great. I can't say enough about it. Wow.
Yeah, it was a great time. It was I think it was like you know, great people there, and you know, I got to say that the food was pretty awesome this time. You know, we had Zach.
There's a lot of it too.
We had Zach. He was cooking up this mojito chicken. Man, that was good. And then, you know, we had roast beef
plastic
there.
Kong.
Plastic Kong. Plastic Kong.
Yeah, he's like, there's Zach. He's grilling up. He's got a video.
He was
going.
So proud of himself. He's grilling up with the tongs. And Howard comes out of nowhere, and he's like, what are you doing? So, yeah, it was great.
Yeah, so perfect. But it was all those things that Howard said, and more. You know, I had a great time, Obviously, I can't drink 10% beer.
No, let's get on to that point now. I'm glad you segued us into this. So we finally wrangled your ass into the kitchen to do the auction, which was a trick, and you are going downhill quickly. And, of course, Balin isn't helping because he keeps pouring you shots. Yeah. So
what was he drinking? Was he drinking bourbon? Was he drinking bourbon with him?
Yeah, but he kept trying to get Eric to drink something, and I'm like, if one more thing goes down Eric's throat, it's coming right back up, and a lot of other stuff is coming, too. So we're doing the auction. All of a sudden, I turn to see Eric going through a door, and I'm like, where's he going? Eric, tell the people where you went.
You know, I'm sitting there, we're doing the auction, and at one point, I'm standing up with my hand in the air. I don't know what was going on there.
You were yelling a lot. Your South Philly came out. You spoke with your hands a lot, almost smacked me in the face twice.
Oh, my goodness. let me apologize in advance for yelling and screaming. But, you know, the passion was flowing, baby. The passion was
there.
There
was no filter on the passion. You drove the filter. Yeah, Jesus.
Did somebody mention morphs? Is that what happened?
I don't remember.
I might have said something about zebra sibs or something.
Somebody might have said something about that, and you started screaming about something, and Zach was antagonizing you by going, oh, the South Philly coming out, and then, of course, you just kind of went full bore like you were from, you know, Broad Street, but go on.
Well, I guess everybody knows how I feel about the zebra sibs now, but anyway.
Yeah,
anyway,
apparently.
I'm looking over at Owen, and I'm going downhill quick. And at this point, I thought I'd stopped drinking, but according to you, Owen, apparently not. So I'm looking over at him.
You stopped drinking when we got you inside, and we kept trying to give you bottles of water because you were fading very quickly. And we were trying to bring you back up so that you could kind of hold on until we were done with the auction.
Yeah, now let me preface this by saying I'm not really a drinker. I don't really drink. Like, I don't drink. I drink, like, maybe socially, and that's it. So it's not like you're going to come to my house and, like, you know, see a case of beer in my fridge or something like that. But so I'm drinking, I don't even know what it was, River Horse or something, and it's like 10 or 12% alcohol by volume. And it was good beer, but... Ooh, don't drink a lot of them. But anyway, I'm sitting there and I'm talking to Owen and we're doing the auction and I look over at him and I'm like, dude, I gotta go. And he's like, what?
You moved quick. By the time I turned back, you were already gone.
I was out the door and I was like, I was either gonna get sick on Owen or outside. I made the right choice.
Which would have brought a whole new level to Carpet Fest.
Yeah. And then I remember coming in with a second wind, and I was kind of like rejuvenated, and I was like, okay, here we go. And then I think it started going through it again, and now I get into this, like, I'm tired phase. So then I don't know if this was after the auction was done or not.
It was done. It was after the auction because Zach came over to me, and he's like, where's Eric? I'm like, I don't know. Weren't you watching him? And it's like... No, I haven't seen him for a bit. I'm like, all right, I'm going to check him out. And then we're wandering around. I have expected to see you, like, passed out in the middle of the street. So we're wandering around trying to find you. And Zach's like, well, here's his car. And I'm like, is he in the car, Zach? And I see you, you know.
Yeah.
You apparently got tired and went into your car and passed out. But you locked the doors, which was intelligent of you.
Martin.
Yeah, you bastard.
I remember at one point I just kept seeing flashes, and I was just...
Oh, like, yeah, well, I took your picture while you were in there.
I kept seeing flashes and flashes, and people kept coming out, look, he's in the car, look, he's in the car. And I'm like, oh, boy, this is...
Now you know how the animals at the zoo feel.
It literally felt like 10 minutes. It felt like 10 minutes. And I woke up.
No, it was like 2 hours.
Yeah, I had left by the time you got back up.
Julie comes out, and she didn't even, like, get to the car, and I, like, sprang up like a spring. I was like, boing, oh, what's up? I feel better now, you know? And I'm like, okay.
I do give you credit for that. I do give you credit for that, Eric. You were just, like, you were gone
for a while, and then you came back, and you were right as rain.
Right.
And that's the way to do it. No, you were solid, man.
Yeah.
When you came back, you were completely solid and a lot more lucid than the rest of us that continued to drink for the 2 hours.
Yeah, and you puked in the grass, which is good.
Look, everybody's drunk. What happened? But
that's why I got dead grass over there. Okay, I was wondering.
Yeah. It's better that than your driveway or the hood of your car, dude. So
somebody tried to
saran wrap your car. Yeah,
and they failed miserably.
Apparently, Zach kept ripping the saran wrap, and they were unable to fully wrap your car.
If they would have, if we would have done this right, we would have saran wrapped Eric.
In the car. That was the plan I put forward, and that's what I thought that they were doing.
Saran wrap the car while he's in there.
Yeah, he would have been so confused and trapped. It would have been great.
Because I can't just push through the saran wrap. But anyway.
Oh, yeah. I would have. The second we got it going, I would have gone to 7-Eleven and bought more. So.
That's awesome. Yeah, Howard, I mean, like I said on the thing, you know, big thanks to you for opening up your house and all the work that you put into it and, you know, hosting the event and, you know, the responsibility of that comes with that. And, I think it was a good time. I had a good time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was great. There's a lot of people that were that have been here in the years past that were unable to make it due to traveling expenses and family obligations. But it worked out very well. And it was, you know, one of those, it was, you know, that tight-knit group of people. And, you know, Eric, this is your, you know, brainchild. This is what you wanted to do, and it worked out perfectly.
Yeah.
You know,
the auction. How much did we raise for the auction?
$2,400. Yeah, it was almost about $2,500.
Okay.
So.
Which is awesome. I got a message from Rigo tonight that he appreciates it and, you know, thanks for everything. So that's awesome.
Definitely.
That's good. That's good. At least that's what it's all about. You know, that's what needs to happen. You know, it's. You know, I know there is, you know, we're donating this year, we are donating to both USARC and RICO, but at least with the donations towards RICO, they're going into his pocket, man. They're going directly to him. And I'm not a chondro guy, but I'm a snake guy. I'm in the reptile community.
Right.
Right.
And I'm going to give, you know, whatever I can to you know, kind of a give it to home, you know?
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I've always loved, besides the, you know, carpet pythons and Morelia, but the people that are in the community. We have our differences at times, and, you know, sometimes we don't like each other, sometimes we like each other, but at the end of the day, it's like a big family, you know, and you go through that with
it
your
really
family,
is.
Too. You know, and we might not all agree, but the one thing that I can say is that I see a lot of respect for people. And, you know, the one person going out of their way to help another person in need inside that family, even though you might not keep said species or sometimes even you don't like the person. But just because it's like a close-knit family, you take care of each other. And, you know, you don't see that a lot, at least with my experience. I don't see that in a lot of other communities.
Yeah.
But, if you know, it's awesome.
You don't. And I know people that, you know, like Julie, bred ferrets and bred dogs. I have a friend of mine that's a rabbit breeder. If you want to get your neck slit, hang out with rabbit breeders. They will destroy you.
No shit. Wow.
Oh, no, they're nasty.
Wow. I mean,
they'll disembowel you just as soon as look at you.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the cool things too, Howard, that we were talking about before, and kind of the idea is to get to know each other on a more personal level. And that was what kind of Friday night was about. You know, I was ranting and raving or whatever, but you get we weren't even talking snakes. We were talking religion and all kinds of crazy stuff. And
that was the good thing about it is we weren't talking about reptiles. We were talking about everyday life stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And even though me and Howard or Zach and me or Zach and whoever didn't necessarily maybe agree, you know, we still listened to each other. And I don't know about you guys, but it gave me a better understanding of who you are. You know what I mean? And how you work.
Right.
And what you're about. Right.
Who you are as a person. And I talked to Balin. I talked to Jason Monday.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Once again, you know, it's kind of like a Tinley, after a Tinley weekend, we're trying to piece stuff together. But anyway, and I was like, dude, I hardly ever talked to you. I didn't say anything to Balin, but because, you know, we already have that connection. And Julie, she told me a couple years ago in Tinley that every year she goes to Tinley, she finds someone else and gets to know them.
Right.
As a person and who they are and what they are, aside from the reptile world or anything else. You know, who's Eric? Let's hang out with him. Let's talk to him about, you know, his home life, his job, his, you know, religion, whatever it may be, or anything, you know, and just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Social security number. Yeah, all that fun stuff.
Yeah. there was great stories, great time, and, you know, now it looks like they're going to do a Southwest one, or a Southeast one, and...
Mm-hmm.
There's also the Northwest is coming up on, when is it, July 27th? 26th.
I've been saying the 27th. The 27th is a Sunday. It's July 26th. To put it out there, contact Heather.
Yep.
Arshimbo. Everybody knows her. Everybody loves her. Contact her and she'll line you up with everything for the and I get out there. The plane fare's astronomical right now, but then again there's that point of me being there for this and helping them figure it out.
Yeah,
I would love to be able to go, and I kind of have the date saved, but it's just the fare. You know, if I can get the money together for the fare, you know, I'd love to head out there. You know, because you got guys like Nick, who's actually on hold right now, but he's going to be out there. And, you know, talk to the guy all the time. What's that?
All you got to do is get out there, man. You got a place to stay.
Yeah.
Somebody will put you up in their house.
Yeah. It was cool about this carpet fest. We had Jade and her boyfriend Travis drive up from Georgia to hang out with us. That was cool. So driving and traveling can be done.
They were cool folks too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I guess if you're on the fence with, you know, you're out there on the West Coast and you're on the fence on whether you should go, I don't know their list of people who's going, but I know last year they had, you know, Nick was there and Justin was there and Casey Lazick was there and, you know, I mean, these are some big name guys in the Morelia world, and you know, to be able to talk to them and again, like I said, to get to know them and have a couple laughs with them, and you know, it puts you on another level, I think.
Yeah.
And makes you tighter. So.
What's Nick gonna eat this year though? I mean, like, didn't he eat the rat last year? I mean, he's got to top it somehow, right?
Yeah, I guess so. We'll have to ask him when he comes
on. I forgot about that. We we really didn't do anything to best them. No, we did. We did. We did. And it's something that you cannot share. But if you were here to see Mr. Burke's activities, then that tops a lot of things.
Yeah, watching Eric stumble around and yell at crabs and eat the lungs of a crab after someone told him not to.
Did that stop eating a rat?
Yeah, he ate them.
Yeah, I ate them. Yeah, well, you know, I was like, I wasn't in the right state of mind, and the guy, like, intimidated me because he's a Maryland guy, and, you know, he's, like, going to it, and, you know, you guys
don't eat that, and you're like, why not? And it's like, because you're not supposed to.
I'm like, damn it. Okay. Whoops.
Yeah, well, no, I got to revert to that because I think that's something that's humorous is I hear Eric say, I'm eating crabs like I'm from South Philly. And I was like, I'll show you how to eat crabs like you're from Maryland. So I grab a crab, rip it out real quick, and I'm just tossing him the meat. And he's just looking at my hands, looking at the meat, shoveling it in his face. And then, it's done. I was like, don't eat those. Why can't you eat those? I was like, because you'll feel like poo. And guess what?
Guess what happened? Yeah.
I'll tell you what though. The next day, I felt great. I drank a whole bunch of water before going. Like I said, I bounced back at the end of the night. But I drank a whole bunch of water and I was ready to go. So.
Yeah. And somebody, you guys might be able to. Who broke a glass in my house?
Zach Baez.
That was Zach.
That was Zach.
Yeah.
All right. Was it one of my scotch glasses?
I think so. I don't know.
The only reason I said I don't care, you know, and I'm sure it might have been. Somebody probably said, hey, Howard, we broke one of your glasses, and I probably said, well, clean it the F up.
That's pretty much what happened, yeah.
Okay, that's fine. The issue is I stepped over this piece of glass multiple times on Sunday and even Monday, and then I found it Tuesday.
Oh, wow.
And then once I found that one piece, which was a large piece, I found glass all over the place. I was like, ah.
Oh, so they didn't do a very good job. Well, it was drunken people trying to clean up after drunken people, so.
Yeah, that don't work out well.
But people have to understand that Howard doesn't wear shoes.
That is true. You don't.
Yeah.
Not for any particular purpose.
Yeah.
Next year we'll take plastic cups.
All plastic cups.
Yeah.
No. It was good. Well, see, you know, that's the thing is, the salmon vodka would have cleansed the wound.
It would have.
It's no big deal. So what did I pay for that?
$30.
$30.
$30 for that.
Yep.
Salmon vodka.
And then you also paid $40 for my gavel.
Did I really?
Yeah. You auctioned off my gavel, but I took it back anyway.
But did I pay you that $40?
I don't remember. You auctioned it, but I don't think I counted it or collected it.
Oh, I'm sure I did. I was like, all right, look, how much do I owe you?
That or you put it into your pool and you donated another $40 to Rico. So.
Just tell me how much I owe you, and I'll just give you the money.
somebody
could have walked away very wealthy.
Yeah.
Very wealthy.
The funny thing was trying to watch you and Balin split a bill of $60 and throw money at me, and I'm like, no, this is like $90, guys. Stop it. And, you know, neither one of you was paying attention. So.
Right.
No, that was the $60 for the for Chris Koppel.
Uh-huh, and you're trying to split it, but 20s and 10s are being thrown all over the place.
Yeah, I was trying to call Chris, and I was like, how much do you want to bid for it? And Jason's like, well, we'll just get it for him, whatever, here's money. And we're throwing money back and forth, and we're like, wait, why don't we bid on this instead of just throwing cash all over the place?
Why don't we win it first and then deal with it? Yeah.
Right.
So.
But.
Anyway, Chris got it. I do need to give a shout-out to the wonderful people at Animal Plastics, both Mark and Allie. You know, Allie's the lovely voice you hear all the time, and Mark's the guy back grounded in the shop, making sure everything's taken care of.
Right.
And cranking out stuff. And they don't do – I've talked to them, and they don't do – they ask for a lot of donations, and they just don't do them.
Right.
Because where does it stop?
Right.
Sure.
You can be asked for donations every day of the week.
Sure.
But where does it stop? But they felt it necessary to be able to give to Rico. And, you know, I'm a valued customer.
That helps.
And... that helps. That helps. Yep. I've spent. Yeah, they have my money, but it was just very nice of them to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Put up that auction, and I endorse. You know, everybody that's been here sees. You know, has seen my rooms and how I do the. You know, everything's white, animal plastic stuff, and it's. It's a solid product.
Oh, absolutely.
There are a lot of other products out on the market, and we all like our own. You know, we all like, you know, what works for us, but that just works for me. And, you know, it's one of those things you see other people come into your room and they see all this, you know, everything. It's a conformity thing. Everybody sees all this stuff, and they're like, holy
right.
crap. Like, yeah. That's,
yeah.
It, yeah.
There's some
better than a zoo exhibit.
There's some I can tell you after seeing firsthand Friday night, me and Zach were giving Howard a hand cleaning snakes, and where most people would look like that as a job, cleaning snake shit was actually fun for me at least. I don't know how Zach felt, but
that's because I got tore up by napalm.
Yeah, and yeah, right. Yeah, that tiger was evil, man. Good Lord. I got to say, Howard has some very top-notch jungle that's going on and some very sweet pairings from this year. So, you know, you should definitely check out once he has stuff hatching out and some really cool clutches. And one of the things that we talked about was – and again, see where we can jump back in between geeking out snake-wise and then coming back into talking normal. But I was noticing in your egg boxes were so big. And I started asking the question, why were they so big? And you said that, you know, the air with the mass of the eggs and, you know, you explained what was going on. And then Zach had said that Tracy Barker actually has a equation that she uses, which I still have to look up. Actually, maybe when Nick comes on, he might know this. But, you know, these are things that, you know, it's working for me, like what I'm doing, but maybe it could be better. And I never would have thought of using a bigger egg box because of the air, you know.
And the way I figured it out is, like, experience. You got to do it, figure it out, trials and errors. I've done some things that are great. And I've failed miserably. But that's what comes with just doing it.
Right.
You know, you can read everything you want. You can parrot everything you need to on, you know, from what you've read and your knowledge. But until you get the hands-on, you know, until you get the boots on the ground, it's up in the air.
Then you're applying what you've learned and...
Yeah.
In real life scenarios and such. So.
And but I do think you're right. Is that I think there has to be a some kind of ratio between the egg mass and the volume of air for air exchange, and that depends on, you know, Jason's, you know, in the same state right up the street from me. Well, it's a ways, but anyway. our climate's the same, our humidity, temp pressure drop, everything else is the same. Our rooms are different.
Right.
Our rooms are completely different. What works for him might not work for me.
Right.
But I do think that there's a ratio, because I've had small clutches in larger egg boxes that didn't do well. Once I put them into smaller egg boxes, they flourish.
They did
completely flourish. So I think there is some kind of ratio between the negative and positive space between the eggs and the nest, the egg box.
Right.
And I got a creepy gecko guy, Nick Exposito, crunching numbers for me, trying to, he took measurements and figured everything out and trying to do some, put some science into it.
Okay. You know, and that's often people talk about morphs and all this other stuff and this paint job and that thing, and which is all cool, but that's the other part of it, that of this hobby that is cool, you know, that kind of stuff and figuring it out and, you know, seeing a little piece of nature and how it works and how, you know, what makes this thing tick. And, you know, that's kind of what, you know, I guess in a couple minutes we'll bring Nick on, but that's kind of what his research paper that he's working on is all about. You know, he's trying to take it to the next level and, you know, which is cool. So, overall it was a great time. What's that?
Can I tell you guys something real quick?
So
as you know, I have that one female that's doing an MI clutch. The other mothers that I plan to do a MI on aren't too good at it.
Right.
But I pulled a clutch from two different females, and they're still, I took them out, I soaked them for
still
a couple hours, dried them off, disinfected their cages, cleaned them out, fresh newspaper, put them back in there. And they're not coiled up, but they're still doing the shakes. They're still trying to change that temperature. And I showed that to Julie Sunday, and she's like, well, they can, some of them can just pick up on it. Others, you know, smell the eggs from the other girl a couple racks up, incubating the eggs. Nick, the jackass silly gecko guy, he said that he had a friend that actually took a clump of rags or pillowcases and coated them in some kind of varnish,
right,
and let it air out. And then when he takes the eggs from them, he puts them on those and they incubate them.
Oh, wow.
They sit on the rags for 2 months. And Julie, that's what Julie said. She's like, yeah, that'll be done in 2 months. And my photographer buddy was over here on Monday, and I was showing it to him, and they're all doing, you know, the muscle contractions to try to raise the temperature, and they have no eggs. And I told him, I was like, dude, that's why it's fascinating, is just to see behavior like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah, yeah. It's just incredible.
Yeah. That's why I love them. So, awesome stuff. Any other shout-outs you want to hit up, Howard, before we bring Nick on?
Yeah, Reading Reptile Breeders. I got a bunch of fun jungles, and if you were here, you see I have a bunch of fun stuff, and it was a very good year for me. The Northwest Carpet Fest, it's pricey as hell to get out there. Right now the flights are $543 round trip out of Maryland.
Right.
So that's kind of rich.
Where would you fly into? Where would you fly into? Seattle?
SeaTac.
Okay.
Seattle, Tacoma.
Okay.
So that's where I fly into. Luckily, you know, you always got a guy. I know some people out there. So
yeah.
That's good that are willing to give yourself a space.
It's one of those things, man. I just got to get there. Just fly your ass here, and I'll take care of the rest. And that's the friends you need.
Right.
You got it.
That's cool. All right. Howard, once again, thank you for opening up your house to us again. And, you know, much appreciated, and all your hard work is much appreciated. So big thanks to you. And I would also just make sure people, if you're looking for some jungles or some crazy-ass tiger jags, Howard's your guy. Check it out. He'll be at you're going to be at Hamburg on the next upcoming.
I will. I won't have anything available at that point. I have two more jungles left, but come August, stuff's going to get silly. You know, with that Luke Snell red jag and that tiger that I have paired up. It's gonna. You guys have seen the animals in person. It's just gonna be.
They're gonna be pretty.
Good stuff.
They'll be fun. And Owen, if you need a female, man, I got you.
I do. You know I do. You know I need some jungle females. All my jungle females turn out to be boys, and that's not helpful.
I got a female for you, and I think I'll have some nice jungles this year.
Cool. Then I will let you know.
Okay.
All right, folks.
All right, Howard.
Thanks a lot, Howard.
All right.
No worries. Enjoy your evening.
You too.
Bye.
See ya. Okay. So, that was Howard, Reading Reptile Breeders. And we're going to be bringing Nick on. Nick Mutton. If you don't know who Nick Mutton is, maybe this is the first time that you're tuning in. Maybe you
stop
were,
listening. If you don't know who Nick Mutton is, you clearly are on the wrong radio show. Move along.
He owns and operates Inland Reptiles. He also wrote two books, The Complete Carpet Python and The Complete Children's Python. He does a show on Herp Nation Radio, which is awesome, by the way. I don't know if you've caught that, Owen, but the last show that talked about morphs on a genetic level and genetics behind snake breeding, and it was just awesome. It was one of those things I had to pull out a notepad and listen to it a couple times. But that's on Herp Nation Radio. It's called The Nick Mutton Show. He's also now a writer for a column for the magazine, which, again, if you're not a subscriber to that, you're definitely missing the boat. And now he's going to come on and talk about his other project that he has going on. And, hey, Nick, welcome to the show. Or welcome back.
Hey.
Again, with the time or something, yeah.
Yeah, been a few times probably. Yeah. A couple times.
It's okay.
Man, sounds like I missed out not going to the East Coast Carpet Fest from the festivities.
I did not know Eric could move that quickly, but he was gone like a lightning bolt out front. So it was fun.
Guys are out of control.
Yeah, it was pretty out of control.
Yeah.
Man, can't handle that anymore. I'm getting too old for that stuff. But, body can't handle it.
Apparently my brain thought I could, but my body said I
couldn't. Body couldn't. Yeah, exactly. Nothing can hurt. It just. He didn't know that yet.
I'm telling you, man, getting old is bullshit. all that stuff, used to be so easy when you're younger, and now you just get older and your body just, can't do it anymore. Man, I'm telling you.
Owen don't know about
Sounds like everybody's having a great breeding season.
Late breeding season. I got four females that are still yet to drop but are showing all the right signs. So
better late than never.
Exactly. I don't freaking care. Do it whenever. Just give them to me. Yeah. There are no rules here.
none that snakes can't read the rules very well. So,
exactly. Exactly. So I don't care when.
You can make generalities, I suppose, but they're kind of, you know, there's always the outliers that do their own thing. So.
Of course.
Yeah, I think it might be just too good of a... For the first time in my life, I'm actually freaking out because I've done too well. Have you ever had that where you think, like,
yes.
Oh, you can't have too much of a good thing? It's like, well, bullshit.
Yes.
You can,
yes.
Apparently. I have literally, I do not know what to do. I am beyond past the point of being out of anywhere to put eggs, and they just keep coming.
You've broken your emergency baby racks.
Oh, no, no. Every year I have to build a new emergency baby rack, and then I have to build another one that stacks on top of that, and now there isn't anywhere to put another rack. Even if I wanted to build one, and I would, my building is like completely, every inch is used, and there's a giant island in the middle that's on wheels because it's in the way, and it holds 200 babies, and
cool.
I would need, I'm, and that's not even close to enough now. You know, we all do this. I mean, everybody says they try to limit their production. We all basically just throw it against the wall and see what sticks. Let's face it, you know. We all do it. I mean, you know you're not going to get everything you try for, so you kind of like there's a little bit of cushion. You got to kind of overshoot it a little bit. If you want 100 babies, if you want 4 clutches, you try for 5 because you know you're not going to get all 5. Well, this year I got all 5. And by 5, I mean 30-some-odd. I mean, I did rest about 5 girls that I did not, I just, you know, they needed, you know, you don't want to breed them every single year. You got to give them a year off now and again. So I rested a few, but with maybe like 4 exceptions, every single thing I put together laid eggs or is trying to lay eggs. It's just,
shit.
I'm going to cross 600 babies, I think. I mean, that's just ludicrous. Because you know, I don't have employees or anything. That's just me.
Wow.
Damn.
When you get that many babies, that's literally like 15 to 16 hours just to clean all the babies.
Yeah.
2 full working days just to clean the babies. It's nuts. And it works out to be about 1,800 hopper mice a month, which is gets pretty costly.
Jesus. You know, by the time you're done cleaning the last baby, it's time to start over.
Yeah, it's exactly what it is. I'm going to have to bring on an employee
shit.
Or something, or just to help me clean babies or something. I don't know. You know, it's crazy. And it's not all carpets, but it's mostly carpets. I mean, I got, you know, there's a lot of other, it just seems like, you know, all but one ant I bred went. I mean, all but a couple of carpets went. I mean, there's just a couple of, I can count on my hand, on one hand, the number of females I put a male with that did not lay a good clutch. Or have, you know, there's still like 11 more that are due to lay, but. Both incubators. I have huge incubators, both completely full. I've got tons of females maternally incubating. I have like a couple of, like 3 big, they're like rolling coolers that have like fans and heat elements and thermostats built into them. So when I go to a reptile show, I can take all my stuff as in like a high-tech cooler setup, so it's all heated. Even when I'm on the road, everything's 80 degrees. Nothing ever gets cold. Well, you can use them as, you know, overflow incubators and stuff. So I got eggs all over my house. And even then, I'm still, before the first clutch hatches in like 10 days, I've got like 8 more due to drop. I didn't even know what, you ever get so frustrated with something, you just quit thinking about it, even though you know you're working to the abyss?
Yes.
I was like, I can't even process what I'm going to do. I'm just going to go eat something.
I'm just going to ignore it.
I'm just going to go make a sandwich. I didn't even know what to do.
That's future Nick's problem.
I've got ball pythons maternally incubating clutches for no good reason other than there's nowhere to put the eggs.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to have to figure something out next year. I'm going to have to really be a little, I mean, a lot of, it's not like stupid stuff. It's like all these things you've been raising for years, you're all excited to finally they're ready to go, and then you try it, and like, holy crap, everything went.
Right.
You know, here.
You all weren't supposed to do that.
What am I going to do?
Yeah.
The one I'm really worried about, I've got a female that I've given this female 4 years off, and she's 9 feet long and 30 pounds, and I'm thinking, how many eggs is this thing going to lay? And do I even want to know? I mean, it's like, I might have to make some, like, Brettles python omelets or something just to...
Oh, my God.
Something. I don't even know. It's going to be that many. Could be. Although every time I freak out about this, usually the universe kind of steps in and gets some...
Some somebody helps, Yeah,
it's like, ends up being not quite as bad, but there'll be a lot of good carpets, sounds like, from between everybody's having for carpets, and I see a lot of good clutches all around, not just mine, but I mean, it's a lot of people. I know you're having a good season, Eric. Things are looking up, and a lot of people are starting to produce some pretty interesting stuff, so.
Hey,
getting into carpets, it'll be the best year ever.
Yeah. Just on a side note, did you guys see that picture today of that carpet that they found in the tree?
They found in the tree? Yeah.
Did you see
that? I don't know if it's even a carpet. I mean, I was just looking at it, and while I was waiting forever for you guys, because you're supposed to put me on at the beginning, so I was only supposed to be on for a few minutes. While I was listening to the show, waiting to come on, I was looking at that, and I enlarged the picture, and I don't even know if that's a carpet. It looks like I think it might be an ant.
Oh, really?
It doesn't look like anything I've ever seen before. I mean, it's like, it doesn't look like any Aussie colubrid either, for that matter. It's kind of...
Well, my question is, if you're out in the outback and you see that and you take a picture of it, wouldn't the next picture be of, like, somebody climbing up the tree to get it? I mean...
Any of us would be so... It would be
exactly. Give me closer pictures.
The head of it doesn't look... It's too low a resolution and everything. The body's really, really round, which kind of almost looks a little like you'd expect an ant to be. But the only ants in the Darwin Botanical Gardens would be children's pythons, which would be, that's a pretty far cry from anything. So, I don't know. It's cool, though. It makes you wonder. There's always still stuff out there no one's seen, and stuff pops up.
True.
It would be, whatever it is, pretty darn interesting. So,
cool.
Who knows? I'd like to see a higher resolution picture. Maybe it's just somebody screwing with you with Photoshop or something. I'm going to put this picture up there and watch all these idiots speculate.
Get my hopes up. Jerks. Yeah.
We all start waxing poetically about what our opinions of it is, and it's all just BS or something.
It's all just, yeah.
I don't know. Who knows? I got my attention, but give me a better picture, and otherwise, you know, who knows?
Right.
So if you're listening in the Darwin Botanical Gardens, go get it.
So with all these, we talked about, you know, like I said, your books and all that, your radio show and your column that you're doing now in Herp Nation, and now you have another project that you're undertaking. You've cared to
Yeah, I just figure, why get any sleep at all, right, when you can have the problem going once, you know? I mean, we need to sleep, right, you know?
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
I'm the king of taking on too many things at the same time, maybe I'm having a midlife crisis or something, or nearly midlife crisis and stuff, but as I get older and I'm feeling my age a bit more, it's like everybody's got their kind of bucket list of things they want to do before they croak and stuff, and I'm kind of like feeling pretty empowered lately to get some of those things done. So one of those things is I, for some weird reason, want to be an author on a peer-reviewed academic paper dealing with herps, and that's a very difficult thing to do. The standard of writing and stuff, and it's like the hardest standard you could possibly imagine. It's like whatever kind of writing you do, nothing is as hard as getting something to peer review. The whole point of peer review is that a bunch of PhDs then read your paper and then try to destroy it. And and if you survive all of that, then it becomes kind of part of the official permanent scientific record. And I just very much would like to leave some minor contribution to our scientific knowledge, however insignificant in the grand scheme of things, I suppose. But I just want to do that, probably just because it's hard. I mean, because it's really super difficult, and I'm probably not supposed to do it, therefore I want to do it. And I've been thinking about it for years, and I was I had Dr. Warren Booth on my show talking about parthenogenesis a couple months ago, and we started talking about, you know, other avenues of research and things he was looking into doing and everything, and kind of came to the conclusion we're both kind of looking, at the same sorts of things, and I have a lot of relevant samples and stuff. So basically, Dr. Booth and I are working on a paper dealing with monozygotic twinning in pythons. Not exclusively monozygotic twinning, it just happens that most of the time that's what you're dealing with, apparently what you're dealing with and everything, and trying to establish rates of twinning for various python species and stuff. So I thought I'll call my friend Eric and have him put me on the show so I can beg total strangers for clutch data, because with carpet pythons and some of the, some pythons like ball pythons are mass-produced in quantities most people couldn't even imagine. So you can get your hands on thousands of eggs worth of data. When you've got, for something that's going to be going to peer review, an academic paper, you can't just base like a percentage on like a few clutches or a few hundred eggs. You need thousands of eggs. Otherwise your sample is not, because twinning is a rare event in any case, you need just a mountain of data to have any sort of, otherwise you'll get destroyed in the review process. If you don't have a statistically significant enough sample, it's not going to tell you anything. you know, small sample can be skewed pretty heavily. If you've got 100 eggs, that doesn't tell you much. If you've got 500 eggs, maybe it tells you little. But if you've got 5,000 eggs, you can say something, you know, when you've got this, you know, there's certain power that comes with large numbers and stuff. And, you know, you make a much more convincing argument when you're talking about thousands of eggs. The problem with carpet pythons in particular and some of these other species is that no one has thousands of eggs. So you're really kind of stuck. You either need to get a lot of data from a few people or a little data from a lot of people. And with a lot of these things, you kind of have to cast a wide net and stuff. And that brings us to today. I've developed a little, not developed, that makes it sound too grand, but written up a little spreadsheet and everything for all the variables that we'd like to track and get submissions from listeners of your show and from far and wide to submit clutch records and clutch data. Morphs don't really matter at all. What matters is the geographic origin of the animals. You know, is it an IJ? Is it a coastal? Is it a jungle? Mixes are okay, but we need to know what the mix was. My basic hypothesis is that you see, in some species, you see an elevated rate of monozygotic twinning, and that there is likely some evolutionary advantage to do that. But there's some positive selection going on favoring identical twinning in some species. Not all species, in fact, very few species. But in some species, in some places, you see this, what appears to be a high rate of twinning. And all of us who've bred carpets for any number of years have all had twins and stuff. And it's hard to find somebody that's had a number of carpet clutches and not ever had twins. They seem to throw twins at an astoundingly high rate relative to other things, you know, up to 10 times the rate of a lot of other things and stuff. So knowing, you know, kind of knowing that anecdotally doesn't really prove anything. You need to, like, you know, even if you suspect strongly and lots of personal experience, and in my case, I've had literally hundreds of carpet clutches and produced more twins and even, you know, multiple sets of triplets over the years. It's like you need to be able to quantify that scientifically is, you know, is a different, you know, entirely different thing and stuff. So need lots and lots and lots of clutch records and stuff. There's a lot of variables I'd love to track because some of them deal with you've got two parts of the equation. Are they twinning at an elevated rate? And if so, elevated compared to what? You have to have something you're comparing it against. And if they are, in fact, twinning at an elevated rate, why are they twinning at an elevated rate and stuff? This paper started out kind of smaller in scope, and it's kind of expanded and turning into a bigger thing because there's more questions. If you get enough data, there's a lot more questions you can ask. The why. You can test this phylogenetically. We'll be doing extensive genetic testing and stuff of twins and triplets and everything, proving are they identical or are they fraternal twins. You know, there's this occurs in a couple species at what seems like it might be an elevated rate, and if you can identify some commonality at a genetic level between those two species, like where is this, is there a genetic thing, you know, area you can point to and say this is the area that's responsible for this rate of twinning or that is possibly elevated and stuff. My own data so far suggests, you know, I get a twinning rate of about 1%, which sounds like, you know, one egg out of 100 might have twins. Doesn't sound like much, but if you look at, you know, I think in Dr. Ben Morrill in his thesis, he did a lot of work with ball pythons, and he had about 10,000 eggs and had a twinning rate of about 0.1%. One egg out of 1,000 would have twins. So even though that tiny 1% sounds like very few, if it's 10 times what, it still might be 10 times what you see in other species.
Right.
So there must be some positive advantage conveyed by having had twins. It must be being favored, or, you know, it must work. There must be an advantage to have that elevated rate. I've got a hypothesis as to why that is, and it's not totally, it's not all in carpets. It doesn't appear to be, at least anecdotally, and with the limited, incomplete data that I've got now, it doesn't appear to be widespread in that it's not all carpets doing it. It's some carpets doing it in some places, in regionally, that there's a regional bias possibly as well. So, you know, you need to, if you've got enough data, you can, you know, establish a twinning rate for the Spilota complex as a whole, for, you know, this species, this group, that group, this region, that region. You can dissect the data any number of ways and see what it tells you, but you need a lot of it to do that. So that's what I'm here tonight to beg and plead for and stuff. It's a little bit, there's a little bit of a, you know, a few caveats to it and everything. You have to keep kind of a high level of integrity of your data. You can't, you know, unfortunately, there are people out there that just want to tell you what you want to hear. time stuff. And if they want to be a part of this or that, and maybe they fudge the numbers, maybe they can't remember, so they just guesstimate, you know, or whatever, you know. It needs to be real numbers, you know, and it needs to be honest. And there's no, and strictly speaking, though, the focus of it is twinning would make you think, oh, the clutches with twins are thus more valuable to the data set than non-twin clutches. But really, in terms of the most important question, is establishing a baseline rate for twinning. The clutches without twins are equally valuable as the ones that do have twins. It's like, and you can't, I've had people so far, I've had a few people like they want to give me some clutch data because they had twins in one clutch 2 years ago. They want to give me some information about that clutch. Well, you can't do that. You can't cherry pick just the one clutch out of a year that had twins and ignore the three clutches that didn't, because then it creates a bias, statistical bias in your work, and it creates the appearance of a higher rate of twinning because you can't ignore the ones that didn't and only include the ones that do.
Right.
Stuff. So I've got to, you know, it's got to be like we settled on, you know, the whole year's worth, you know. So it's like, if you've got a clutch of twins this year, I need all the clutches from this year. So it puts in the context. In your collection, if you had five clutches, you had twins in one, I need the numbers from all five, not just the one that had twins, because that's context, you know, that's to keep it honest and everything and stuff.
Right.
Because it doesn't do any good to, you know, the point is not to cook the books and, you know, create an inflated rate of twinning. It is what it is. And it's, you know, so we got to be very careful about that, not cherry picking clutches and stuff. You know, an isolated set of twins without context, you know, for DNA purposes and stuff would be useful if you've got shed skins of, you know, the twins and, you know, their parents and stuff. For that purpose, it could be useful. But in terms of establishing that rate of twinning, it would need to be, you know, you kind of need the context vis-a-vis the rest of the clutches that were produced that year. If you only have one clutch, then, you know, that's, you only have one clutch. That's fine. But can't cherry pick the ones that give you the more interesting results and stuff. But I've been kind of fascinated by the twinning thing for years, and maybe I'm just a glutton for punishment, but I have several adult twin snakes that I just held back because they were twins. I've got a male breeder, Ivory Jungle, that was a triplet. I bred a triplet to a twin once. That was a train wreck. I mean, you do get exactly what you think, it seems, at least in my limited sampling. Twins seem to beget more twins. Go figure. And I've got a female. That's my most beautiful jungle. It's the most beautiful jungle, one of the most beautiful ones I've ever seen. I love this snake. And she just laid 19 eggs for me again a couple days ago. But this snake has laid, 4 years running now. This is, and she needs a year off after this year. But although her fecundity rate hasn't, she's always in that 18, 19. Hasn't dropped at all. But the first three clutches, I've had multiple sets of twins and triplets in every clutch. First year, I got three sets of twins. One was a two-headed zebra, but that's a conjoined set of twins.
I've been there. I had a conjoined twin.
The first year, I got three sets of identical twins. The second year, I had two sets of identical twins. The third year, I bred her back to her own son. I got two sets of twins and a set of triplets. I got 18 or 19 eggs in the cooker right now, bred to a different male that's not related to her, and I fully expect I would be quite shocked if there were not some twins in there, you know.
Wow.
So you get these animals that just habitually throw twins and things, even using different males. In fact, of the four clutches she's had, there have been three different males out of the four clutches that have had three different sires, and I just get twins like crazy no matter what. So there's a reason this is happening. I've had males, I've got records from other people who submitted data to me where a guy, I just got the data from him a couple days ago, he had bred the same male to two different unrelated females and got multiple sets of twins and triplets in both clutches from unrelated females, showing that, at least suggesting strongly that, you know, this propensity for twinning can be passed along through the male, because what are the odds, you know, just like in people, twins are rare, but triplets are just unfathomably rare.
Yeah.
I'm only aware of just now probably seven or eight sets of triplet carpet pythons. I've had three sets over the many years, but, you know, that's exponentially rare and stuff. So to have two sets of triplets and two sets of, you know, multiple sets of twins and triplets from two different females sired by the same male suggests this is working and happening for a reason, and it's trying to figure that out and everything is interesting. So
cool.
That's what it's all about.
So what do you, like, what do you need? Because, like, I have a clutch that hatched the beginning of May,
there were no twins in it, but should I, like, get all that data? Because then if one of my other clutches that comes hatches a twin, you're going to want everything, correct?
Yep, you should get everything. Incomplete data is fine. Like, so in the spreadsheet, there's a few variables on there. Some of this, I've got about 100 different writing projects going on at the same time at various stages. I've got a,
right.
I've got a column for Herp Nation now, so in every issue I've got to have a column. But I also have like 5 feature articles that are in various stages of completion, including one that I've been working on since before the magazine existed. I've been working on the maternal incubation article for years. Every year I just wait, oh, after this year's data, I'm done after this year's data, one way or the other.
I'll plug it in.
It's mostly written. I just like keep waiting for more, putting loggers in clutches and getting more data, because the more you got, the cooler it looks and more species you can include and all that and everything. But,
hey, Nick, hey Nick, real quick, I got a you just brought up maternal incubation, and our good friend David Kelly has a question about that, and he wanted me to ask you if whether you know maternal incubation traits like shivering or protection are ancestral or derived in various lineages.
You know, that's a really good question, and one I'd be really interested to know. No one could really answer that. You know, it's something. It's a question that probably could be. Well, I don't think you could answer it definitively because it's more of a behavioral thing. You could speculate and have some well-informed speculation, but no one's really done any real research in that and everything. I have noticed that even among carpet pythons, you see different. There are different. It's not all the same thing, which leads me to think that possibly it's not. It's derived and independently. Derived in different lineages, that it's not necessarily something ancestral, because they go about it in different ways. Some species don't do it at all. Some species do it really well. Some of them do it, but they do it in a different manner and stuff. Basically, the further south you go, latitude, you see greater use of thermogenic shivering, so your coastal carpets are really good at it. Diamonds, inlands, all those things, because in brettles, if they don't do it, their eggs won't hatch. They just die, so it's kind of a necessity. Where it gets weird is when you get up to the subtropics and the tropical areas where you see species don't shiver. Ball pythons don't shiver. I got a ball python on eggs with a data logger right now. They're just sitting there. Antaresia don't really engage in any shivering thermogenesis at all. Olive pythons, this is my third go-around trying to do this with olive pythons, and they just seem to sit there. But they generally live in an area where they don't need to do anything. The weirdest one seems to be jungle carpets, which don't seem to shiver a whole lot, even though there's really no genetic distinction, but there is no genetic distinction at all, for that matter, between your typical more northern, central to northern coastal carpet and a jungle carpet. So genetically, it's the same snake with a different paint job. But they don't seem to shiver, but a coastal that comes from roughly the same geographic region does. Is it just an artifact of, you know, environment? The animals in this particular area that live in closed canopy rainforests don't need to, so they don't. They didn't inherit those instincts from their predecessors, and animals that live in more open eucalypt forests where it might get a little cooler at night do. I don't know. It always seems to work. I mean, I've got a jungle maternal incubating partly just because I think it's neat to watch. It's just, if you breed snakes, I mean, what Howard's talking about, making like a surrogate pile of eggs and stuff for them to, you know, because they're having some separation anxiety. That's behaviorally interesting. I don't really understand why you'd want to do it, though, because it takes a lot out of them to lay the eggs. It takes a lot out of them to do that and then immediately go on a two-month longer fast while they are sitting on them. So it's like, I don't know. I mean, I've had many females do that where they do the shiver sit under the paper and shiver on a pile of nothing. But if you wash the snake off, they usually, after a few days or offer them food, they kind of snap out of it. It's hard on them to do it. It's what they're physiologically built to do, but I mean, I guess I don't understand why you'd want to let them go shiver on nothing for no positive gain. I mean, if you're going to do that, leave the eggs. It's really neat.
Yeah, exactly.
I
mean, yeah.
It's fascinating to do and stuff, and I would encourage anybody, carpets are the undisputed masters of maternal incubation. There's no, you get coastal carpets and, you know, brettles. Some of these things are just really good at this. Because, like I said, they have no choice. That's the difference between, you know, success and failure reproductively. You've got to be good at it. And animals that aren't good at it, don't leave a lot of offspring, at least in the wild anyway. So it's just, I don't know. like everything has its life cycle, and this is what they were designed to do. I mean, you're looking at animals nearly, you know, like 85 million years of evolution to do this job, and they're really good at it. And to, like, kind of pluck the eggs away all the time because we think we can do better in a box, you know. I mean, I incubate a ton of eggs. I don't maternally incubate everything. But every year I let an increasing percentage just for my own amusement, really. I just like, you know, I breed females 2-3 years and they give them a year off. The last year I usually let them keep their eggs and everything, and because I'm going to give them the year off, next year off anyway.
Right.
And, it's just so much cooler to watch them go through that whole process and everything and kind of peek in on them every day. You know, and you can watch as they'll relax their coils at certain times. They'll seal them up really tight. They'll even piss in the corner just to raise the humidity in the box sometimes. They'll move the whole clutch around, move the nest box around. It's fascinating. So a lot of people are kind of afraid to try it. I get that. But it's really just the illusion of control we have, isn't it? You know, they think that somehow this crazy contraption they built is going to do a better job than Mother Nature really. And that's really, it makes us feel better, but it's really, we don't. Some things, you know, I don't know. I mean, in species that don't, you know, engage in thermogenic shivering, that's, you know, a little more nerve-wracking.
Right.
But in the species that do, they know what they're doing. If you get a female lays them, you know, I pull a lot of clutches almost primarily because they lay them in a bad spot. I mean, I give every female's got a great nest box. Everything's exactly right, nice, everything's perfect. You'll still get the ones that just insist on ignoring the nest box and laying them on the heat pad under the paper. You know, I mean, you get that. Or sometimes you get ones that'll lay them in just a stupid configuration. You want that nice little ball of eggs. You'll get them,
right.
I want to do my maclots for my article. I want to put a probe in the maclots because whoever maternally incubates maclot eggs. You know, I want to do that. I wanted to have some liaises in there. And she laid them, it never went in the box once, laid them on the heat pad in this 10-egg clutch in a low, flat disc. It was like a round pile, not a pile. They were all, no egg on top of another egg, just a perfectly round, flat disc. There's no possible way she could have really effectively shivered on those eggs because the shape of the mass. So I was like, well,
right.
I had to pull them. Or, you know, it's not going to end well. You do get that, or the occasional ones that don't seem to even know what they're doing. You know, if they look like they're doing good, give it a go, man. It's a lot more interesting to watch. And even things we worry about so much, like, oh, what if there's an egg dies, or what if there's a slug or an egg dies? It's actually less of a problem. I've watched, like, a fertile egg will die on occasion, as happens, just like it happens in your incubator, only it doesn't mold. If you've got in a nice, humid incubator, if you've got an egg that dies and you leave it alone, it'll get some crazy stuff growing on it, and that mold will grow all over
like different colors of, rainbow shit,
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like molds, you get like, you know, gray mold, black mold, brown mold, red and green and blue. It's like the dark molds aren't so much a problem. It's the blue and green is that's the stuff you want to keep away from your other eggs if you can. But when an egg dies in a maternally incubated clutch, it just shrivels up and looks like a dried up raisin. It kind of weeps a little bit, and you get some like brown, smudgy crud on the eggs next to it, but it doesn't seem to have any effect on the other eggs at all. Because there's more airflow and mold needs, you know, humidity and still no air movement to grow. That's why you don't just see mold growing out in the open. It's always in like some limited amount of airflow situation and stuff. And in the coils of that female, it's less of a problem than it is in an incubator. So it's not anything to freak out about and stuff. I don't know. That's my 2 cents on maternal incubation. Years ago, I used to be the control freak guy and thought I could do better than the snake and everything. And my old friend Yasser, who I've had a tumultuous relationship with over the years and stuff, but we kind of buried the hatchet a while back and everything. But he was always, you know, big into the maternal incubation, and I started doing it, partly because he just kind of badgered me into doing it and everything. And he's right. It is an interesting. Have you guys ever had him on the show?
Yasser?
Yeah.
No, I don't believe so.
No,
he's an interesting
we tried.
Guy. You might want to.
We tried
kind
a
of
couple times,
sometimes.
But yeah.
We're
calling you out, Yasser. You need to come on.
Rebel.
He's had a lot of experience with a lot of different things and stuff, so he might be an interesting guy to look up. But now the MI thing, I'll never do every clutch because it's very, you know, I don't know. I mean, I breed snakes full time, so you do need to breed females in successive years quite often.
Yeah, you can't knock out your entire collection all on an MI.
You can, I mean, you can breed a female in successive years doing maternal incubation, but it is their natural rhythm is not to breed every year. I mean, most of these things are biannual breeders, even triannual breeders, and if you want to,
right.
So it would be difficult and everything. So but every year I do a bigger percentage of it, and I do different species, even just for fun, because it's just fun to watch. So
of course,
everybody should give it a whirl. Don't be afraid. It's really easy. It's like if you're ambient air temperature, you know, don't do it in a cold room. But if you have a, like many of us have a, you know, snake room with an ambient air temperature of, you know, 80, 82-ish, put a box with some decent substrate in the corner, and that's really all you need to do. I mean, they know what to do. And the wild carpets are just going to go find some rotted-out eucalypt tree and crawl up in a tree hollow, and, you know, it's kind of insulated by the trunk around it because they're, you know, rotten log specialists, basically. And they're going to do their thing, and it's not really any more difficult than that. Sometimes they ignore the box, but I mean, I know friends that have just leave them in the cage. I've seen just sitting on some aspen in the corner, not even in a box, and they still do okay. I give all mine a nest box because that simulates, you know, what they would naturally do. It also probably makes it marginally easier for the female, and that in an enclosed area, if you're trying to heat up a smaller volume of air, it's, you know, it's going to be easier to do than in a larger volume of air, i.e. the whole cage, but I've seen tons of times people just leave them just right wherever they drop them and stuff, and it works out just fine. So, fun stuff.
Cool.
Back to the research and everything. I've got that some of these variables I'm tracking also kind of dovetail with my maternal incubation paper. You know, if you're quantifying a rate of twinning, and then you also want to know, well, how big are the twins? Because all these things are kind of, like anything, the reproductive biology of anything, it's all linked together. It's, you know, if they're twinning at an exponential rate, not exponential rate, an elevated rate over, you know, other species on average, you know, why is that? And why are they must survive, you know, at least 51% of these twins must be surviving, ergo they must be surviving at a high enough rate to justify doing it. And if so, why? It's like, why would a female want to have a few extra babies that are smaller? And I think that probably comes down to it's basically buy one, get one free. You know, anybody who's bred carpets knows they look like an empty sock after they lay a clutch. It really sucks the life out of them. Yeah, it's like you feel bad for them. It's like, you want a drink of water or something? I mean,
it looks like I nearly killed you.
Oh, it does. It does look like it nearly kills them. And so one of the things I want to, and it dovetails with my maternal incubation research as well, it's like, you know, I weighed all my females before the start of the season. I weighed them after they laid their clutches. And then if they maternal incubated, I'll weigh them after the eggs hatch. And so I want to establish, it'll have ramifications for the academic paper I'm working on, but it'll also be in part probably published ahead of time in the maternal incubation article, is what is the cost of reproduction for a female carpet python? What does a baby carpet python cost the mother on average? What's the cost of making one baby carpet in terms of lost body condition for the female? Because that's your motive right there. Why would you want to have two babies in one shell? It's like, because if it costs you X percentage of your body, you should be able to calculate a percentage of lost body condition in terms of mass per baby produced and stuff. That should be pretty easy to do, and if you get enough data. And if you know that, then the answer to why you'd want to make twins is obvious. You get one extra baby, but you don't have any additional loss of body condition and stuff. So,
true.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a sweet spot with the size of neonates, prey preference, and what temperate zone they live in and stuff, because all that speaks to survivability of little tiny babies and stuff. You don't see, you don't see Antaresia twins very often. Why? It's like, you know, even though you eat lizards mostly, it's like you're too small to eat anything if you only weigh 4 grams. What are you going to eat at all, you know? You don't see twins in ball pythons a lot. Why is that? Probably because they're too small. Ball pythons are mammal eaters. If you hatch out just big enough to eat a mouse-sized mammal, great. That's what you eat. If you hatch out half that size, you're too small to eat the thing you're looking for. You know, if a ball python hatches out, it only weighs, you know, 20 grams. Like, what the heck is it going to eat? What are the odds it's going to run into a hopper or a fuzzy? It's not going to run into that, you know, or that size is very unlikely to run into something in that size range that it's keyed into wanting to eat, so your survival rate is probably much lower. Carpets seem to, at least some populations seem to fit into like a sweet spot where what they want to eat, you know, if you eat lizards and frogs and things as juveniles quite frequently, if you cut your hatchling size in half, there's still a smaller lizard or frog you can eat because your twin carpets are roughly analogous in size to, like, Antaresia babies. And that's what they
right.
eat. And they're sympatric with Antaresia. It still works. You can cut them in half in size, and you still... And there's still something for you to eat. Whereas if you're really small, like an Antaresia, and you cut them in half, there's nothing to eat. If you're a mammal eater and you cut them in half, there's nothing, you're not likely to run into anything to eat. Retics throw twins like crazy, too. It seemed to be another one that throws twins at an elevated rate. Retics are so huge as babies, even if you cut a retic baby in half in size, it could still eat a mouse. Because it's just a giant snake as a baby. They're so big that
it
almost goes the other way. They're so large, even a twin retic could still eat an adult mouse because
Jesus.
They're huge. So it might be in that extreme end of the spectrum. It works again, and thus you see this. You know, so I don't know. I mean, this is all, you know, my hypothesis that's been brewing in my head for quite a long time and stuff, and my own experience over the years. But ultimately, the data will bear that out. It might be that, what if I'm, you know, you'd be totally wrong. Maybe it's not, and nothing is doing it at an elevated rate. Maybe it just seems that way. But if you get the numbers, you'll know. You can really kind of say, yes, it is, or no, it isn't, with some degree of confidence. Up until that point, it's all just speculation and, you know, drawing inference from personal experience and stuff. So it'd be nice to have hard numbers, and that's what we want to do.
Right. Awesome.
Cool.
So Eric was supposed to put up a link on one of his myriad of Facebook
that,
pages.
That is up.
It's up.
It is?
Yeah.
Yes.
Are you doing it while I'm talking to you?
Yes. We're multitasking, dude.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. Did you put a link to the spreadsheet on there for data collection?
Yep. Yeah, they
where
can,
people can
they
get
can,
that?
Yeah, they can
awesome.
Download it from there. I uploaded it and then put your email address on there so they can email the info to you after they do so. And I also put it over on MariahPythonRadio.com. You can go over there. And
so which
see
one
it.
Did you put it on? Which pages did you put it on?
I put it on Morelia Python Radio, and then I'm going to move it over to Morelia Python Pick of the Week.
Yeah, like 2,000 people over on the Pick of the Week.
That definitely
so.
Turned into the page of choice for carpet python aficionados, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah.
Apparently we did something right. So
yeah. There you go.
Well, you
but yeah, anybody it's, anybody listens, I would love to love to have anybody's data and everything. Just to contact me via Facebook or email and everything, and I'll get you all set up with what you can contribute. I would say to anybody that because that we're talking about a academic paper, everybody that contributes data's name will be there somewhere, because you can't just, you know, give a bunch of data and say, trust me, it's all good. You've got to, you know, show where that data come from. Where this data come from, and it'll be a lengthy list, but I mean, it will, everybody will, I guess in a lot of ways, it's like a lot of guys' chances to contribute something to kind of a scientific kind of a thing, and that, you know, I geek
sure.
out on that kind of stuff. Hopefully other people
well, I
do
would
as well.
Too. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Man, well, I'm counting on you guys. You guys got a lot of eggs, so if I don't get submissions from you guys, I'm really going to be in trouble.
Well,
I got mine.
I can tell you already. Yeah, I can already tell you right now. I got 22 no twins so far. So.
Yeah, well, 22 no twins. It's a, you know, I mean, it seems like with me, it's about one egg out of every 100. I've never had a year without twins ever in almost 20 years, but I produce a lot of clutches, so there's just always. I couldn't imagine a year with no twin carpets.
Mm.
There's many years I don't even have data myself because I didn't write it down because it wasn't even a noteworthy event. So in my own
right.
data, I probably have 3,000 carpet eggs to my own credit, but I don't have data for all of them because, you know, some of these things in earlier years or, you know, computer crashes later, lost notebooks. Some of it's, you know, on note cards. Some of it's in notebooks. Some of it's on old hard drives. I mean, I don't have all the stuff for myself and stuff, so...
Right.
So I need a lot of people and stuff. So, but yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
That's
awesome.
Awesome.
Stuff.
Were you saying something else? I think I cut you off there, Owen.
Oh no, I'm just talking about like the pick of the week, and you threw up that is that a super caramel jag?
Yeah, striped one. I got a clutch coming. One clutch coming from him.
Very cool.
Yeah. That's another MI clutch. So. See, I don't even know how many eggs there are. Over 20. It's a big pile. I don't
nice.
Know. I've got all these. I've got five super caramel things. It's all bred to non-caramel anything to prove them out and see where we're at. With that,
cool.
I'd be a little surprised if any of the ones that I bred didn't prove out. But who knows? We'll see. I got huge clutches, so every one of them laid 20 eggs or so. So I'll know pretty decisively in one shot. So
excellent.
Yeah, and then I got to figure out what to do with all the babies because I seem to
a lot. Yeah, there's that. Yeah.
Sometimes, like, even these little girls, like, 20 eggs? What are you doing? You're killing me.
And where'd you fit all these?
Like, 12 eggs or something. What? Yeah, I don't. And then sometimes I get, like, these bigger ones that don't lay very many and stuff. It's, there's probably, if you had enough, like, large, again, the power of large numbers, if you had enough clutch data from enough, with enough variables from enough females over here, you could probably figure out, why do some certain lineages throw more eggs? Is age a factor? Is it just purely a ratio of body size to clutch size? Is that the thing? Or is there, is it a bloodline thing? Is it a species thing? Is it a, is age a component in that and stuff? There's all kinds of things. If you had a large enough data set, you could figure all kinds of stuff out.
Right.
And stuff. So, some of those things, a little too much to go for all in one shot, but, I think I'm shooting for probably, I'd like to have, in the vicinity of, 15,000 to 20,000 eggs worth of data for all species and stuff. Now, there'll be a lot of, ball python data because that's the primary outgroup we'll be testing against and stuff because I can get, huge numbers of eggs and stuff. So you have to have something to compare it against. Again, it's like if you're saying something, suspect something twins at a higher rate, it's, higher rate compared to what, And stuff. So you got to have something to use your primary comparison and everything. But now it's expanded to like any python species, whatever. I mean, I'm never going to get 1,000 water python eggs, worth of data or, 1,000 Sabu pythons. But, anything you can, it's kind of at this point, collect everything and see what you end up with. And if you end up with enough, you might be able to say, it might be something like, if you look at, African species versus, the carpet python complex, you can make this kind of head-to-head comparison and stuff. But you can also include anecdotal data and stuff that may suggest, however speculatively, based on, a couple hundred eggs of this species, and we didn't see anything, but it was based on a small sample size. As long as you say it's based, it's not really definitive because it's a small sample size, it still adds to the overall totality of everything in the paper, so...
Right.
So, yeah, I'm excited. Cool. I'm stoked.
So any python, doesn't matter. Use it. Cool.
Yeah, I mean, anything, as long as it's, whatever it's supposed to be, and you've got, there's a lot of data on there that I know most people will not have. Most people do not weigh their females before the start of the breeding season. Mm. I didn't even do that until this year, but I did it this year because I knew I was going to be doing this. So I did it this year, but... I don't even normally do that. There are a few people who do, but a lot of people don't. That's one that's a hard one to get. But at the minimum, it's like, what were the parents, how many eggs did they lay, and were there any twins? If I can get those three things, what was mom, what was dad, how many eggs did you get, and were there any twins in there, that's useful because that's the minimum for establishing a rate of twinning. Eggs that haven't hatched yet, are just hatching now, if you weigh all the babies, because that, then you can calculate the average size, get a really good estimate on average size of babies from these different points of regional origin. I'm just speaking about this below the complex stuff now and stuff. And you can, because why would you want to know how big the babies are? Well, if the babies are average size this big, twins are, and then the twins you have, however small a sample that is, are averaging whatever percentage of that, however much smaller. It speaks to that survivability of these twins. They are, even though they're considerably smaller and everything, they must still be surviving. So it's relevant in that, in that area and stuff. So the weight of the babies is another good one. But even if you didn't weigh them, but you kind of got to weigh them pretty much when they hatch. You only got maybe a couple days later they're going to start metabolizing that yolk, and then you got to kind of do it right out of the chute and stuff. If it's too much time to elapse, then they might be lighter by a gram or whatever, and it might skew things a little bit. So,
right.
But even partial data is good,
right?
And stuff. So okay. Hopefully somebody will listen and can help me out with you know, a couple clutches here or there from 100 people would be great.
There you go. Yeah,
it adds up, though.
I got my stuff ready for you. I'm just waiting for the other ones to happen.
I know you do. You're the crazy guy who even writes down the phases of the moon when things are happening and stuff. I mean, that's yeah. The nice thing about taking good notes. It almost seems like it's a lost art. Like old school Herpers used to write down just, and I'm very much an old school guy, but you know, I'm not ancient, but I've kind of got the old school guy mentality, I guess is what I mean. But I write down a lot of stuff and take good notes and stuff. And the nice thing about that is when something happens, you usually know why. It's not a lot of surprises. You know, and if you're successful with something, you typically know why. You know what you did. I mean, how many times do you know somebody, like, bred some rare thing, and then you ask them, they have no idea how they did it. There's no idea what was going on. No, I just chucked them together, and I don't know. You know, and they'd have no idea what was going on or what they accidentally created the perfect environment for, you know, X, Y, and Z to happen, and they don't know how to do it, and thus they can't replicate it again because they don't even know what they did the first time. And I've seen that so many times and stuff.
Right.
At least you write everything down. It's generally reproducible. You know what you did, so you can try that again the next year because it worked the first time, you know, or
right.
The tenth time or whatever. So,
what you did here, do it again. Good job.
Yeah, we all do. I Howard touched on this a little bit earlier. It's like everybody, there's more than one way to skin the proverbial cat or carpet python.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I see people do things, I think, there's no way that's going to work. And then it works for them, you know, and stuff. I mean, you can speak in generalities about this works well or this works, you know, it's proven to work well for so-and-so. But, I mean, there's no, snakes don't read books, you know, and stuff. And
no.
They don't get on the internet much. And, you know, individuals, you know, individual results vary. And there's a lot of, like, variables that, you know, particularly with, like, temperature and climate and, you know, humidity. And these things are kind of, we live in different regions and different regional climates. And these things have an effect on what goes on in our snake rooms, whether we, even at a level we don't even realize or understand, I mean, and stuff. So it's hard to really totally know exactly what's going on all the time and stuff. So sometimes things, are not always what they appear. But,
sure.
I would suggest, though, if something's working, keep doing that. You know, the old, hey, bro, don't fix it. It's like, this works great. I mean, I'm not changing nothing. This, my own self, I mean, for where I'm at and what I keep, I've got this pretty well dialed down. I mean, it works real well. But, I mean, you know, if I lived in Florida or Texas, I mean, you've got other concerns. You've got, you know, that other people, you know, this far north may not have and stuff. So
right.
It all, where you are makes a difference, too.
Sure.
Yeah, it does.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So.
Even where you keep your snake room. I mean, mine's in the basement. Eric's is on first floor and run entirely different rooms.
It works better than Eric's, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't have to do as much to mine. He's got a window, though, so I'm jealous of that. But it just run differently, and we both get success, but we have to do different shit. So.
Yeah.
I gotta tell you, man, basements are where it's at. I mean,
my basement.
In my house, I had when I put up my snake building, it's no bigger. I had two rooms in the downstairs of my house. I actually lost 4 square feet putting up a building. It's not a very large building. It's 4 square feet less than I had when it was all in my house. It's just, you know, you start having a family and you need the house space and wives want snakes out of the house. And all that kind of stuff. So, and, you know, make a nice new bedroom down in the old snake room and do all that, and you're remodeling your house. But basements, because you've got all that kind of that dirt insulating, it's particularly, like, I'm, you know, 2 hours south of Canada, so, you know, we get hard winters. I mean, we have 2 months without it getting above freezing in the daytime sometimes, even.
Mm.
So that earth, it's like it keeps you cooler in the summer and warmer in the winter, and it makes it a much more thermostable environment. It's very easy to just, like, get your room all dialed in to be whatever temperature you want to be, and it'll stay really level because that insulating properties of the earth around it. Now I've got a freestanding building up at ground level, obviously, and it's much harder to control. You know, you've got, there's a fence that runs along one side. The fence casts a shadow on one side, and it's like 6 feet away from the building, and the shadow the fence casts, it's a solid fence, creates one corner that runs constantly like 3 degrees colder than everywhere else, no matter what I do. Just that little bit. The fact that the building, one wall faces south, I get southern exposure. It heats up a lot. I mean, it's a very different animal, and I spent a lot of time. I mean, that It has 8-inch thick walls of solid insulation. It's 8 inches of insulation, 10 inches in the ceiling, 2 inches of rigid foam insulation underneath the concrete floor. And it's insulated like you wouldn't believe, and it's still, it's, I wish I'd built it underground or something. That really was a lot easier and stuff.
Wow.
You know, I don't have windows in it, but because why would I have a window? I'd have to, if, you know, I'm not going to have an open space where there's not a cage. I mean, it's like, I even knew that at the time. I didn't even kid myself thinking I was going to have some free wall space that wasn't being used. You know, it's pretty much every possible, and then you keep rebuilding things. How can I shoehorn more stuff in here, you know, and make this even more efficient and stuff? Because,
right.
So words of the wise, any of you herpers out there that actually get to the point of putting up a snake building, make it bigger than you think you're ever going to need it. Because you're never going to want to make it bigger, and your wives will never let you make it any bigger. You're kind of stuck. So it's, do it right the first time, overkill it, you know. Even, you know, make it 50% bigger or twice as big as you think you're ever going to need, because it's better to need it and not have it than to have it and not need it.
Yeah.
So,
but
exactly.
You know, like, herpers will, we have a tendency to fill empty holes.
Oh, we're all a bunch of freaking hoarders anyway, aren't we?
Yeah.
When you start bringing stuff,
oh,
it just gets way worse, because then you like make all these cool new things. Oh, I can keep all these, and I don't have to pay for them.
Right.
It's like, oh, look at all the free stuff. I mean, I'm going to hatch a bunch of albino Darwins. I'm just going to go crazy. I'm like, I got an albino to albino clutch of the day. It's like, well, guess who's getting some new albinos this year? It's like, this guy right here, you know.
Yeah,
because I can't help myself. I hold back things I don't need for no good reason. And then I look, I'm like, what am I doing? Because it's
neat. Pretty.
So many, yeah, what am I thinking? I held back like 11 zebras last year. I'm like, what am I doing?
Wow.
It's like, yeah, well, I've wised up and sold one of them. I still have the other 10.
There you go.
You know,
you got rid of one out of 11. That's fine.
I made ivories. I finally got a clutch of ivory to zebras, which took me, for some reason, took a long time. I just had bad luck making that clutch, and I finally got it, and I got 2.5 ivory zebras that, quite honestly, defied all really expectations I had. They're just way, they got way more out of the ivory side of the parentage at 50% than I thought they were going to. They look like what I thought 75% ivory zebras would look like at 50%.
Wow.
So I'm thrilled. So I just kept them all seven of them. And, you know, and then I had my favorite female jungle, the one that throws all the twins, through two sets of twins and a set of triplets. So I had to keep a male triplet zebra and a female twin zebra so I could breed them together and make a whole bunch of babies that are too small to eat and stuff. And, you know, make a whole bunch of pain-in-the-ass babies, little tiny pain-in-the-ass babies, because, you know, why wouldn't you want a bunch of twin super zebras and, you know, all that madness? So I couldn't help it, so, yeah.
Jeez.
I got to always hold back, you know. And, I'm going to have to hold back a bunch from this year, too. It's just, you got to always be, I mean, this is the power of selective breeding and everything, but you kind of got to always be pushing the envelope, holding stuff back, and the best of the best backs, you just keep marching forward. I mean, this is how we end up with these crazy-looking, entirely unnatural-looking animals. It wasn't, you know, by happenstance. It was just hold a bunch of stuff back and keeping the best ones and just keep each generation just refining it and get it better and better and better.
Right.
And there's really no limit to how far you can go with that. There's no limit to how bright you can make something. You know, it's, you can just keep going and going and going until they, I guess, spontaneously combust at some point. But you see some of these jungles, it's like, this is just like, this is just getting ridiculous almost.
This,
I mean,
is
it's
what
just
fire will think,
yeah. Yeah, it's going to start, you know, fluorescing or something at some point. But, you know, that, and, you know, we're blessed, I think, in that we're all kind of, at least I assume most people listening to this show are, we're into carpet pythons by and large, and that's just like, and aside from being the greatest group of snakes ever, that natural variability that just ridiculous amount of natural variability you see gives you almost unlimited selective breeding potential. There's really no limit to how far you can go with that.
Mm-hmm.
With something that's that phenotypically plastic, you can just keep going forever and everything. And you look at all the untapped carpets. I mean, you know, people barely scratch the surface on selective breeding bretels. I mean, yeah, a few generations, but imagine when Brettles pythons have as many generations of selective breeding under their belt as jungles do now. What would those look like? They'll glow in the dark. I mean,
wow.
Look,
yeah,
at even IJs. We're finally starting to get now IJs consistently, you know, really nearly hypo-looking IJs. And there's no limit to how far that can go, you know. And there's a lot of, you know, I mean, everybody's kind of, well, not everybody, but a lot of people are kind of enamored with mutations and stuff. But there's something to be said for just kind of kicking it old school, selective breeding, and just really exceptional examples of wild type specimens and stuff.
Hell yeah.
So that's my latest kick is getting the wild type stuff, you know, the freaking roughies.
Give me a call, man. You never call anymore, and I've got plenty of it.
I know. I know. That's because every time I call you, I end up spending a lot of money. So.
Well, yeah, this is kind of a point,
right?
I know, it's the point.
I'll have everything this year. I mean, I'll have pretty much, if it exists, I'll probably have it, or a couple
Sweet.
Clutches of it. I've got plenty of Darwin.
How about roughies? Did you breed them this year?
How about roughies?
No, that's one of the only thing that just completely
Damn
did nothing.
It.
It's like, I was so excited, and everything is like, they're, you know, they're ready, and I'm just all excited, and oh, man, I can't wait. And, you know, I don't even care about the, well, I can't say I don't care, but making $1 million breeding roughies is not likely to happen. And I don't even, it's not even, I just like them, and I was just excited to breed a new species, and it just absolutely could not have been less interested. I mean, my male, he just sat there like, he just, like, could not have been, I resexed him. I'm like, are you even a male? I mean, what is the deal?
What the hell are you doing?
Could not have had any less interest in breeding at all. He was like, he was just stuffed. Just sat there, did nothing.
Wow.
So that was a letdown. But, I mean, you got a lot of snakes, and every breeding season for everybody will have its share of triumph and tragedy. There will be the things you really want that don't go, and then there will be the things that... Yeah, you know, maybe you didn't think we were going to do anything that do, and no one ever gets everything they want, and you know, there's always those things that are disappointing and stuff. I'll breed them at some point. It's but
you got to and you emailed.
I did see you finally got Brisbanes, which I was excited about.
Yeah, that's like 7 years in the making. There, I've been that project started in 2007. And when I first learned that that bloodline even existed anymore, because they're, you know, when I heard that those things existed, they were already, you know, retired and burned out and, you know, not producing anymore. It was already kind of had run its course and been done, and no one ever really, there were no babies around, and the few that had been ever released presumably all just got bred to jags and disappeared and absorbed into that, and there really were, but those old animals were, those original old, that original geriatric pair of snakes from the late 1980s or so, were still alive. However, I mean, I saw them in person in 2010, and they looked like they were a million years old. Big giant, and it looked like a giant snake that someone let the air out of its tires, like just kind of left, it just kind of looked flattened, you know, like in flaccid,
right.
Like this, like you could just tell that snake is 100 years old. Big old boofy head on him, and just kind of looked out of shape, and just, you know, just wore out, you know, from age and everything, so... getting that resurrected and everything took a while, so, you know, getting,
awesome.
It took, to even get, I've got 2.4 here, and that took 3 clutches from those old animals to get even that. Just, you're getting, like, clutches with 2 babies, you know, and the rest are just duds, and it's just, they're just, these snakes will reproduce into their, you know, into old advanced age, but fecundity rates and fertility rates go in the toilet after a point. I mean, you can still get something. That's not likely
right.
to be great. I've got a 20-year-old jungle that's going to lay this year. And I think, you know, looking at her, she's looking good. I'm thinking there might be, like, you know, I might get low single digits. You know,
oh,
I mean,
my
it's,
God.
Well, like, you know, the best she's ever laid in the top, I've got her when she was already geriatric, and the best I've ever gotten was 6 babies and a bunch of slugs.
Nope.
Last time it was, you know, like 3 eggs, and the eggs are small. The babies are smaller than normal. Even the fertile eggs are small. It's like, you know, this thing is just at the... It might live for another 15 years, but it's at the kind of the end of its reproductive, you know, years and everything. But it's just exceptional, so you just kind of want its genes to keep going and stuff. But it's going to lay something here in another week or so, but I don't expect a lot.
Yeah.
Of course, I got a 21-egg clutch last year out of a 19-year-old olive python and stuff, 100% fertility.
Easy.
So, but, I mean, she's not laid as many clutches as Jungle has, I mean.
Right.
That's another thing. You know, these snakes should live a long time. I think there's this weird, like, hobbyists, I think, would be surprised to know that, you know, I've got multiple snakes that are 20-year-old pythons that are still breeding. And they always seem surprised. It's like, you should be surprised. I mean, they should, with good care, if you take care of them, these things should all live a very long time. 20 years should be, like, the minimum, really. I mean, these things should live 30-plus years in all likelihood, and it's, you know, and it's, you kind of got to look at, like, why are they not living that long? What are we doing wrong, really? Because they're naturally long-lived animals.
Right.
I mean, you get the odd one that might check out from, you know, I've had a number of snakes over the years get tumors and things like that and get cancers and things. I mean, it happens, but barring that, I mean, they should live a long life expectancy, and you see too many snakes, I think, in the hobby. Pythons die way too young, and it's primarily people keep them really warm, they feed the hell out of them, they breed the hell out of them, and then they just burn them up. I mean, it's like, and they die young. They might have left a lot, they might have had a number of, laid a bunch of clutches, and then they crap out when they're 8 years old, and none of these things should be dying when they're 8 years old. I mean,
right.
So, a lot of that's on us as keepers and stuff, really, but, I don't know. I like the old ones. They'll be here forever. I gave the old Olive the year off, though. She's like on every other year plan now. But she's got a date with an albino next year.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm not going to let her maternal incubate the clutch. She has proven to be really bad at that. That does not work out. Two clutches. I had 20 perfect eggs, no slugs, and 21 perfect eggs, no slugs. And, you know, I had two babies out of 41 eggs. She's just not cut out for – I mean – Now, her daughter, her virgin female bred this year, who is, you know, 8 years old, is the offspring of that one. She seems to be doing great. But
right.
So maybe it's just that one female really not that good at it.
Right.
Well, I think there's some unwritten rule that jags can't maternally incubate. They're just too damn stupid. So.
Well, I mean, that's a whole other – jags being stupid is a whole other thing, but –
Yeah.
I'm not opposed to letting one do it. I mean, I got enough eggs every year. I just, you know, I'll burn a clutch just on an experiment. I mean, I do it all the time, but I only have three jag females that are adults.
Right.
Stuff. And this year, none of the three really laid the, they all laid the eggs in a goofy pile, like the pile, like one, the eggs were not very strongly adhered together, so there's a lot of loose eggs in there, and it's like, well, that ain't going to end well for the loose eggs anyway. They're going to roll around and die. And the other ones was like, you know, lay it in this weird low pile or this crazy elongated rectangle where there's just no way they can effectively thermoregulate on top of those eggs. So I pulled them. And I do have one that's pretty wonky. We all have the one, at least.
That one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. They're pretty, but I'm like a lot of people, we're probably all a little conflicted about that gene. It's like,
yeah.
I really like these things, but it's like, I really wish you guys weren't screwy.
Yeah.
I kind of wish you guys weren't so all... dumb.
What?
I kind of wish you guys weren't so, like, you know, just...
Yeah, well, I thought that they're stupid. I think it's just that you've got a, you know, an unlawful likelihood of neural crest mutation that is just, you know, they're not wired right. You know, it's a... and stuff. So, and I'm a total hypocrite, like a lot of people. Like, I breed some ball pythons. I keep trying to have less of them, I swear. I'm trying to get down to, like, 10 total. I'm trying to cut loose, like, 25 breeder females. But I've got rid of 10, which is a good start. But getting it down there. But I won't work with spider ball pythons, but I breed jaguar carpets. And this is the most hypocritical, stupid thing, because it's the same damn thing. I mean, there's no difference at all. None. And even I'm the one that's been shouting at the rooftops that it's the same thing, but I won't work with spider balls. I don't know. Maybe it's like I don't know. The carpet thing, I went years without even owning a jag at all, and then, you know, then Sean gave me one just to... He sent me some stuff, and he put one in the box so I would have one just as, like, a joke. He just gave me one because I refused to get one and everything, and then it started, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Most of them are not too bad. But I got that. There's always that one. We have some exanthic jags here in another 10 days or so. That'll be the first clutch.
Ah, I want exanthic.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what to do with I need to get a male breeder exanthic, but I wanted a good outcrossed one, so I had to go the slow route and make my own and stuff. So, and then I didn't get a normal exanthic. I got an exanthic jag male. It was beautiful, but I didn't. Yeah, I want a male exanthic that isn't a jag also, so I'm hoping to hit on one this year. And they're all heavily outcrossed. I was real picky about getting the hets and all that, so
that's
get a good genetic foundation going and everything, so... I got lots of female exanthics last year, or four rather, but kept them all, of course, because that's what we do, isn't it? The first of anything, it's like, First year I produced Xanthix, I kept every Xanthix, I kept every Ivory Zebra, and I kept, what else? I mean, I do this with everything. I'm like, I just don't let anything go. I mean, all my first super caramels, I've kept all of them, kept all the, I mean, it's kind of the fun part about doing this, though. It's like, I can just keep all this stuff.
These are all mine. You guys can all look at them when I'm done. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm doing right now with this. I got the super caramel Jags, and I'm like, I'm showing pictures to Eric. He's like, are you going to keep them? I'm like, I don't know. Stop asking me. I was going to keep them all.
Yeah, I have too many. I've got like a super caramel female sitting here that would probably breed this fall if I, you know, bother to feed it, you know, at all. It's like, it's almost there. And I'm like, why do they even keep this thing? Oh, because it's really pretty, and I just am addicted to keeping pretty snakes. Like, it doesn't matter that I have five of them. It's like, I'm like, whoa, it's another female. It's like, where am I going to put this thing?
You never know when you could use that extra female. So.
Oh, jeez. I, at some point, the reality of physics and math come in, and it's like, where am I going to put this? Where there's no physical space to put this, or nor a rat to feed this, I should probably, you know, question my own insanity here. With this stuff, I can't do anything in small numbers. Like I got into Candoya boas because why not make a bunch of babies that are tiny and eat lizards, right? And then like some Candoya bibroni, which haven't been imported in over a decade. The tree boas from the Solomons, they're really neat, really docile. You know, it's like they opened up and allowed export, and some of these came in for the first time in over a decade. I just went crazy. And I got like 21 of these things.
Jesus.
Yeah, first I got like a 2.2 of the white phase Solomon ground boas, which I always wanted. Mm-hmm. I paid too much probably, but they're beautiful, and they eat mice right out of these ones. I got the best eaters out of the clutch, waited for years for these things. And then I got some wild-caught ones, and then I got like 11 of the tree boas, and I got some Halmahera island ground boas, which are really rare. And now I got like 21 wild-caught Candoya, or four captive-born ones, and I'm trying to track down some Wago Island tree boas now or something. Just can't... It's out of control. Eric, I know you know what I'm talking about, because I know all the stuff you've got. I mean, it's like...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's out of control. You gotta...
Yeah.
It's
like, I saw Corrales at the last reptile show, and now I got a pair, and I'm like, what the hell? How did this happen? So...
Well, I think my female annulated tree boa just ovulated.
Nice.
So, we'll send you some of those. If you like the Hortulanus... The annulatus are even better. It's like, wow, it's kind of like a Hortulanus that's not quite as skinny and doesn't want to kill me. It's like, it's a little more robust and docile. It's like, well, that's pretty cool.
All right.
they're 1,000 times rarer, you know, but they're neat. I bred them a couple of years ago, and it looks like she's going to go this year again, so it's cool. I mean, I wish she would have gone another year other than this year, because, frankly, I don't know what I'm going to do with the babies, because there's nowhere to put them. Yeah, that is, there is the downside is like where am I gonna put all these baby snakes? Every year I figure it out. Though,
if anybody listening lives near Nick, just go over and help him clean. Maybe build him a rack to drive over. Because
the problem is that nobody lives near me at all. I'm in like this herpetological wasteland where there's just nobody. You know, other than like Ryan Young, who lives like reasonably close, like 45 minutes away from me, you don't get another serious herp until you get to like Minneapolis, I think. There's just nothing. You know, it's there's not a community of herpers where I'm at all. I'm kind of like, you guys are lucky up in the Northeast. There's a lot of you guys and within driving distance of each other and stuff. You know, and that's pretty cool. Some of us are not so fortunate to have the local community and stuff. I got a lot of friends in the business. I talk to people every day, but none of them can come over and help clean cages, though. That's no one can come over and check on my snakes in my incubator while I'm on vacation for me, because they're all hundreds of miles away. But,
ugh.
Yeah.
And that's scary.
I got to get going here. It looks like we're wrapping things up, and my wife already came down, gave me the stink eye. Yeah, because I told her, oh, no, it'll only be like 15 minutes.
Yeah, it was, whoops.
I mean, you'd think experience, you'd probably know that wasn't probably going to work out, but... make some dinner for the family and all that, but...
Okay.
Man, all right.
Awesome stuff. And,
all right, once again, everybody, go to Facebook, check out the page, check out the download that data sheet and get me all that data, and just contact me with whatever you got, and it'd be much appreciated.
Okay. Will do.
All right.
All right, Nick.
You guys have a good one.
You too.
Thanks a lot, Nick.
Bye.
All right, cool stuff. All right, cool. Whoa.
There's an echo there. There's a two of you. What?
Yeah, I know. Right? You can only take one of me, man. Only one of me.
I can. I mean, okay. You got angry at Carpet Fest. Side of you I'd never seen.
Did I?
Yeah, well, because you thought I was burning the Magic Tone book.
I did see that you wrote in the back of it, and it said...
Did you?
Yeah.
Things to do or something like that?
Yeah, like, with my, I was trying to map out, like, you know, because try to stay up on top of everything, right? I'm a list guy. I have to have lists.
I know.
I have this list in the back of this book, right? And it says things to check on daily. Not like I wouldn't know to do this, but I just had to go through this routine, da-da-da. So it's like Morelia Forums, you know, MVF, Morelia Pick of the Week. It says at the bottom, if Owen is alive, if Owen has my book.
What the hell? Well, you went out to puke. You left me alone with the book. I got bored. Phelan said he was going to doodle on something, but then we got distracted because you, like, took the time to map out a potential table display, and then I guess you drew it, like, what it would look like. And, of course, we all see this, and we're just freaking tearing you apart because you're gone. I'm like, did he take a protractor to make this? These lines are excellent. This man, care and devotion into his doodles that I've never seen. So...
That's all freehand, brother. That's all freehand.
Oh, yeah, bullshit. There were, like, protractors and you know, rulers and magnifying glasses. No, this took you eons to do. But, yeah that's what we were doing. Exactly. So I wrote in the Magic Tone book, so it's, like, freaking amazing.
You'll be forever immortalized in the...
forever immortalized. I just thought it was funny. The things to check on the day. Is Owen alive? I should do that every day. So,
right.
Yeah.
I should do that. So I'm glad you're alive today. Glad I checked in and that you're doing good. I'll make sure
that
I check in tomorrow.
You got to check because then you got to make sure you can call Rob or Zach and his own fill in for Tuesday.
Yeah, I know, right?
So,
what the heck?
Yeah.
So, all right. Let's see. I guess we'll wrap it up real quick, and then we'll head out. But I have a quick, I guess you would say, a commercial.
Oh my God!
To throw out there. So we also wanted to let you guys know about a discount that Chris Behoff at CB Reptile.
You all know who he is. Everybody knows who he is. All right. God damn it.
Is now offering a coupon code that you can use to get 40% off of FedEx retail rates through Ship Your Reptiles on your first shipment. The coupon code is, hold on, get your pencils and your pens and your Magic Tone book and whatever else you got.
Your quills.
Pick
sharpen
them up.
Sharpen them, dip them in the ink. Yep.
The coupon code is CBR40. CBR40, and that's brought to you again by Chris Behoff and Ship Your Reptiles. You know, you can redeem that coupon today. I used it. It was great. I just type it in. 40% comes off, you know. I can't say enough good things about Ship Your Reptiles with me personally. The other day I experienced my first shipment from the hub. I never ship from the hub, but it's
You mean you dropped it off?
Yeah. That.
Okay.
Usually I have them come and pick it up, but this time I had them... I went down and dropped it off because it was kind of far. I got out of work late and I had to get the package there, but it worked out pretty well. So now I know I can ship, you know, later in the day and not a problem. But it was good.
And,
so,
you know, I can't say enough good things about Ship Your Reptiles. I mean, the only experience I have with them is when the rust scales are coming, but it's like having a whole team of people who are, it's almost like having FedEx work for you because it's rare because FedEx does not work for you. So it's almost getting that, it's getting the shipping company that you ought to have. So there was, of course, the weather oddity that ended up springing up and the rough scales that needed to be delayed. But, you know, I was freaking out, and unfortunately they had closed by the time I called them, but the next morning, first thing they did is they were running around trying to track down these rough scales for me and trying to stop it and trying to do everything they could to make sure that they arrive safely, and that just goes above and beyond what I think any other shipping company out there would do. FedEx would hang up on you, UPS would not care, and the Postal Service would call the cops. So definitely the best shipping company out there for you. So
right. Oh, man. So, yeah, so definitely go over and check it. Like I said, CBR40 is the code, CB Reptiles, and Ship Your Reptiles. So good stuff. I'll just run down the list real quick. Make sure you check out MorelliaPythons.com. That's the forum, www.MorelliaPythons.com. And if you go over there, Sean Christian, the guy that owns and runs that place, he's asking for our help. Apparently he's a falconeer, and one of the guys that showed him the ropes is in need of a kidney transplant, and they're doing kind of like the booster thing. Morelia Python Radio, we gave some money, by the way, Owen. I didn't let you know, but we put some money over there. Yeah, we did. So, you know, go over there. You can – I had it sticky at the top, but now – Nick's thing is sticky at the top. So I'll put it over on MoreliaPythonRadio.com, and then you can help out. Even if it's $5, you know, the way I look at it, for all the stuff that Sean's done for us, it's the least that I could do for him. So be sure to go and show your support and help him out. I have also, like I said, MoreliaPythonRadio.com. Go over there and check it out, see what we have going on. And if you want to get in contact with us, you have questions or comments or show suggestions, things you liked, you didn't like, whatever, info@MoreliaPythonRadio.com. Be sure to send us a message. If you don't hear the show live, you can always listen to us on iTunes, download the show on iTunes, and listen to us at your leisure, anytime that you would like. As far as myself, we have ebmorelia.com. I have some clutches on the ground, some pretty exciting stuff. Probably the rest of the stuff that I have will be hatching out at the end of June. Of course, I will be away, and it'll be in Owen's hands. So,
God, no.
For the best.
Why are you never home when your eggs are hatching?
Yeah, I know. It's horrible. I can't stand it. I should plan this shit out better, right? I got the
moon
to guide me, and the moon's not helping me, man. The moon is not helping me.
No. You went and you did all those lunar cycles for nothing.
Yeah, it didn't work out. Or maybe plan my vacation better. One or the other.
Yeah.
Well,
either one.
So, we got... hopefully I'll hit on the albino zebra jag and sunglow jag and some sunglows and some albino zebras and some albino jags and albinos. Oh, a whole bunch of crazy stuff that could be hatching out. I also have tiger head albino. Should be some exciting stuff. Waiting for the first shed from the poison ivy clutch before I post up any pictures or anything of what's going on. So if you're interested in anything or want to get on a list or check things out, you can always email me at eric@ebmorelia.com. The other group that I'm going to show out, our good buddy Casper started up a group for Halmahera Scrubs. It's called Morelia Tracii Halmahera Scrub Pythons. You can go and check it out on Facebook. It's actually a really good idea because there's not a lot of info out there. On scrub python or Halmahera scrubs, definitely my favorite scrub species, and it's a good way for all of us around the world to keep and breed these scrub. Well, actually, keep. I can't say breed, not yet.
They breed. No one's done it yet.
Yeah, keep these species, can share information, what's working, what's not working. I personally think they're not that difficult to breed. I just think that, A, not a lot of people have tried. B, they're not mature enough. That's my take on it. So,
Go for the vain one and be like, see, because I haven't tried.
No, I won't say that. But I think you'll see, because there's quite a number of people at the moment that have young animals that are raising up, I think, in the next coming years, just like you've seen in Bolin's pythons, you know, some cool stuff hatching out. You definitely, I think, you'll see that. So just my 2 cents. That's all I got. Owen, take us out.
All right, what we got is you can go to rogue-reptiles.com, check out all the late stuff going on at Rogue. We do have clutches on the ground. The Super Caramel Jag Clutch has hatched, and they are already taking feeds. Most of them have already eaten twice. So they're going to bulk up quick is what it's looking like and be out the door fast. So if you want to get on the list for Super Caramel Jag, Caramel Jag, whatever comes out of this clutch, let me know. We'll put you on the list. We'll contact you once the babies are ready. We do still have some 2013 babies left over. We only have 7. And in that 7, we have 1 caramel female, and we have a few caramel males, and then that's it. You're done. We're out of 2013s. So if you're on the fence about that, let us know. We have an upcoming show. It is June 14th. It's at the Hamburg Reptile Show. If you're in the area and you want to come out to the Hamburg Show, this would be the one to do it. It is my birthday, so I'm going to bring cupcakes. You're going to have cupcakes and goddamn carpet pythons, and I'm going to make Eric Burke come, and it's going to be great. It'd be fantastic. There we go. So come on out. It's going to be fun. Jason Balin will be there. Howard Redding will be there. Maybe Mo. Not sure. It's kind of early in the season, so not a lot of people have their babies automatically, but it is the one to get to. It won't be as hot as the August one. So we hope to see you there. Again, we'll probably have some more shows coming in the coming summer. I know we have the Lancaster show in July, and, of course, we have Hamburg in August as well. So without any further ado or keep jabbering, thank you all for listening, and we'll catch everybody at the normal time, Tuesday nights, 9 o'clock, for some more Morelia Python radio. Yeah, this won't happen again, we promise. So, good night.